Hello, my name is Daniel Nenni, founder of SemiWiki, the open forum for semiconductor professionals. Welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. If you have a topic you'd like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is Amol Borkar. He is product marketing director at Cadence. Since joining in 2018 as a senior product manager, he has led the development of many successful hardware and software products, including Tensilica's latest Vision 331 and 341 DSPs, and 4DR accelerator targeted for various vision, automotive, and AI edge applications. Within Tensilica, he's been responsible for product management, marketing, partnerships, and ecosystem growth for the Vision, ConX, and MathX families of DSPs. Previously, he was at Intel's RealSense Group, where he held various positions in engineering, product management, and marketing, and was responsible for success of a number of RealSense 3D cameras. Before joining Intel, Borkar developed computer vision-based advanced driver assistant algorithms for self-driving vehicles as part of his PhD thesis. Welcome to the podcast, Amol.
Thank you, Daniel, for having me, and thanks for the opportunity. Looking forward to speaking with you today.
So the first question I like to ask guests is, what first got you into semiconductors?
So Daniel, that's a very interesting question, actually. So initially, actually, was very interested in doing application development, software applications, and video game design. So once I actually started getting into when I got into college for my undergraduate and I saw the curriculum for doing computer science, you know, I was expecting more to do, you know, things like Windows applications design and some more fun type of work. But the curriculum is more about, you know, data structures and, you know, the low level programming, which, you know, really did not feel too interesting at that particular moment. So that's when I switched gears and decided to focus a little bit more on the hardware side, where I can, you know, physically build some products and maybe build some electronic hardware to go with it. And that was sort of my foray into how I switched over from software side more into semiconductor side. However, at that time also, you know, that was how the industry was geared, or the curriculum at schools were geared. But now, you know, as time has progressed, there's a lot more computers and tech out there that, you know, the barrier for entry and doing other things is also a lot more different. So if you ask me that question now, maybe I may go back to that computer science part of my choice again.
Yeah, I had a similar choice when I went into college, but there weren't really any software jobs back then. It was all hardware. So I did computer engineering. So why did you get into product marketing? I mean, given your education, it's a little bit surprising.
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. And thanks for asking that. In fact, I actually get asked by a lot of my colleagues, because I have a PhD in EE. That's electrical engineering. And then I also have a micro MBA from Berkeley Haas. And yeah, exactly that question that, like, you know, if you've got so much tech knowledge, why are you in the product marketing field? So I think it's a mix of a couple of things, because primarily for me, what I felt was, you know, when I was in my previous career, as I was doing a lot of engineering stuff, there's a lot of interesting things to do and a lot of challenging problems to solve. But I felt like I did not have a lot of visibility of what was going on outside from the market point of view, where, you know, things are going or where we need to focus on, or also what our group was doing at the high level. You know, it sort of just became like more like you have a spec sheet of things you need to do and you go and solve it within a specific time frame. But, you know, what is the reason for it, or why am I doing it, or what problem it's really solving? It did not address that. So, you know, I first started feeling a little bit, you know, quote unquote, claustrophobic, and I wanted to sort of like up level a little bit and try to understand the bigger picture of why we are doing these things and who's the customer, why are we trying to solve these problems.
Right. And in your current role, what do you do day to day?
That's a great question. So typically, you know, as I've seen in some organizations, product management and product marketing are usually two distinct functions managed typically by separate individuals. From my experience being here within Cadence or at Intel, I found that boundary actually to be quite gray. because even though by title we are product marketing, but we assume all the functions associated with the product. So on a day-to-day basis, I'm involved in product management, which is more of the inbound functions, focusing on here is our, you know, product level strategy. Are we meeting our specs? How is the execution of the product going? Are there any problems? How are we planning to resolve them? And then the outbound side of it also, whereas, you know, the outbound communication, the general collaterals, the webinars, podcasts like this one, you know, giving, evangelizing our products, communicating to the customers, doing the demos, you know, communications on roadmaps, events, trade shows, and then also work closely with partners, because you can have cool hardware and cool software, but if no one can understand what you're doing or you can't showcase your idea, then you're sometimes, you know, limiting yourself. That's where a lot of our partner activity comes in also, where we work with them to create some demos or some cool applications, which are, you know, great for showcasing at events like CES, Embedded World, Embedded Vision Summit. In a nutshell, as you asked, yeah, it's a whole bunch of things that we have to do. And essentially, you know, we are the champions on the products. So we got to focus on the things that work inside and then also the outward communication for the product.
So let's talk a little bit about the technology. Is the merging of vision and radar in the automotive industry, is this real? I mean, you know, why are we doing this?
That's a very good question, actually, Daniel. So we actually have, you know, from a high level, from a product pitch point of view, we have a couple of products that, you know, and product families that address both these spaces, where we have, you know, very successful Tensilica DSPs that are industry leading for vision applications. We also have DSPs that are primarily focused on radar and LiDAR type of applications, which are also industry leading, shipping in many, many, many products. Now, the part which actually was interesting is over the past 4 or 5 years, we started seeing many customers saying that, exactly as you asked, like, I've done a lot of things in vision, I've done a lot of things in radar, but now I want to put vision and radar also in my cars. And yes, it is absolutely real, because there's a couple of factors over here. One is, you know, the technology is evolving. That is, one is a technology from the silicon manufacturing side, and then just the technology that is going in the cars. So if you talk about technology from the manufacturing side, you can see that cameras, you know, are relatively getting cheaper. Now you can see cameras, you know, which were about like 20 years ago, you were probably limited to like maybe, you know, VGA type of cameras that are running at 30 frames per second. Now you've got 4K, 8K cameras in standard dynamic range, wide dynamic range. They are also, all of them are naturally digital cameras also. So interfacing with them is there. So a lot of options. Because of the options, you can assume that, you know, they're becoming relatively cheaper also. That's why you can start seeing a lot of cars which have multiple cameras around them. Typically, they used to just have a backup camera for helping you to park. Now their camera's looking at the front, their camera's looking at the side, their camera's looking all around your car. And so you can see the number of cameras that are going in the car is increasing. Same with radars. Now, initially, it was more of a luxury feature where you had that radar-based park assist, which would tell you if you're coming close to a wall, it would start beeping louder or more frequently. At this point, at least in the US, you can pretty much assume that most of these cars have this by standard. But what we're starting to see now is that while both these sensor modalities are good, they've been pretty much operating discreetly, where you typically would use a camera for one type of operation, but you wouldn't use a camera for something else, or you would use you would use the radars for proximity sensing, but the camera wouldn't work over there. So now, as the technology is merging, we're starting to see a combined usage also a lot of this, where the cameras and radars are both coming together on the cars in a large quantity.
And what about sensor fusion?
Sensor fusion is another area where there is a lot of interest being picked up. So at the high level, just to make sure that, you know, everybody on the podcast is on the same page, sensor fusion typically implies where you've got data coming from multiple sensors and you put them together to get a more holistic view or a better understanding of the environment. So for example, if you've got a camera on the car and you've got a radar, the idea with sensor fusion is I take data from both of these sensors, merge them up together, and then have maybe, for example, a 3D view of the environment, because now you're taking some bits of information from your car and then from your camera, and then you're taking some bits of information from the radar and putting it together.
Right. What about AI? How does AI come into play here?
So it is 2024, so we have to talk about AI, as you know. But yeah, AI is definitely coming in. AI, as you know, is since the past year or so, is pretty much everywhere. It's being used in a lot of applications. And before I get into AI, I'll explain to you the sensor fusion part and how the AI comes in there, is because, you know, you were initially taking all this data from the camera, you were taking this data from the radar, as we said, we fuse it together, and then you would have a better understanding of what is happening outside. And what was being done traditionally was what you would call quote unquote classical approaches, where, you know, with the cameras, you might do some filtering, you might use things like SLAM, which stands for simultaneous localization and mapping. On the radar side, you might do some things like fast Fourier transforms or FFTs, CIFARs, beamforming, put that data together, and then maybe fuse both these data streams together, maybe using extended common filters, particle filters, and things of that nature. But the reason for using AI is because sometimes these classical approaches are not very scalable, because these classical approaches usually require a lot of hand tuning, where somebody will usually write the code, tune the parameters, and if there is a change, then you have to sit there and manually go and make the updates. As the amount of data coming in starts increasing, as the different variants of the data start changing, this does not become a scalable problem. Versus with AI, one of the selling points is the scalability, because if there is a change in the input data from one version to another, a lot of times it can be addressed I'm going to use this very loosely, that you can just throw some more training data at the problem and retune your system. So the scalability problem gets addressed over there. With the sensor fusion, the idea is that, yes, you have your data streams coming in, and there's a couple of nuances also with the sensor fusion, the idea of the types of fusions that are there. There is what's called early fusion, mid fusion, and late fusion. And early fusion is basically when you take maybe the data from the camera, you take data from the radar, pack it up into one data array, and then you send it to your neural network for processing. That's typically called early fusion. Now, late fusion is the exact opposite, where you have your data stream coming in from your camera, you have its own individual camera network, camera-based AI network that does some processing, gives you an output. Same for the radar data, where you have the radar data coming in, maybe a point cloud or something similar, send it into a radar network. Output of that radar network is then combined and maybe sent to a small, could be like a classification network, softmax or something like that. And that way you fuse the data at the back end. So this is called late fusion. And then somewhere in the middle of that, there's no specific definition what you would call the middle, but maybe halfway through in the middle of that, if you fuse that data, you call it mid fusion. But essentially with this, we are seeing a lot of benefits actually, because now, as we said, you know, combining radar data and camera data gives you a much better understanding of the environment, and then enhancing it with AI is how we're seeing some of these sensors actually perform better than they were performing before.
Oh, interesting. So how about AI and sensor fusion? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so a great question, Daniel. So in terms of sensor fusion and AI, yes, definitely seeing a big uptick in adding AI into this component as well. In fact, it's actually very interesting, because if you rewind to about 2016, 2017 timeframe, you would see that most of this AI, this AI trend started with doing a lot of the camera-based or image-based processing, where you had the cameras hooked in, and then they would be processing the image data to maybe first start with the basic classification. Then we went into segmentation. Then we've gone into object detection and all of that. And then over time, we started seeing the different types of sensors being used for input as well. Then we started seeing the enhancements on the audio side. You started seeing things like speech recognition, the improvement in the noise reduction. And then over the past couple of years, we're starting to see radar and LiDAR also processing happening with AI. So it makes sense that you would start seeing a marriage of these different types of sensor inputs coming together, especially in the automotive side, where the radar and LiDAR, radar and cameras are quite often used. So fusing radar data along with cameras, and in some cases maybe LiDAR, also does make sense. And as we talked about earlier, that once you have this data stream coming in, you have multiple ways of how you could process it. So with the sensor fusion, if you do the different type of stages of fusing, so you have late fusion, which is basically one type of sensor fusion approach, where let's say you have a camera and a radar, you send your camera data into its own neural network and you get its output. You send the radar data through its own neural network, get its output. Then you combine those two outputs together and send that into maybe a small, sort of like a decision neural network right at the end. And that could be, the late fusion, because as you can see, we are fusing this camera and radar data very late, right at the end. The opposite of that is early fusion, which is you take your camera data in, you take your radar data in, maybe do a little bit of processing, but then quite early on, you put those two together into one maybe long array or a vector, and then you send it into this neural network, which is expecting to take both heavy amount of radar processing and camera processing together, and then you get your final output at the end. And as you can expect, that was early fusion. We talked about late fusion, and then mid fusion is somewhere in the bit in between, where maybe you do some amounts of processing on each individual network, combine them together, and then you run through sort of like a consolidated neural network that processes some amount of, you could say, partially processed vision and radar type of data. And we see this going to be enhancing more and more as the time goes, because if you look at cars nowadays, the central CPU or the processing unit or the SoC is starting to get more and more beefed up. They're starting to add hundreds and thousands of TOPS of processing capability on these central processing units. So this is just the beginning. We're going to start seeing more and more heavy compute coming in as these cars start becoming more and more connected and start taking in data from more and more sensors.
Yeah, I agree. Cars are going to be supercomputers. There's no doubt. So what about central versus domain controller? Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and what are the advantages and disadvantages?
Sure, that's a very good question. So primarily in the automotive segment, we're seeing that the high level architecture of the cars is going in two directions, as you just pointed out. There's a domain architecture and the central architecture, a central compute architecture. So the domain architecture is, as you can expect, you have multiple domains around the car. So for example, you have a domain for the ABS control of the car. You have a separate domain for maybe the headlight control, maybe a separate domain for engine management and all of that. But what happens with some of this is you have dedicated hardware that might be sitting around the vehicle, and you have interconnects of that maybe going to the ECU or some type of a central computing unit. There's nothing wrong with this approach, and I think majority of the solutions that are out there are primarily domain-based, because that was how the architecture has been around all this time. The benefit of this, obviously, is the localization, because if there's a problem with a certain functioning unit, usually it's you just swap and replace that functioning unit with a new one. So the replacement costs are probably cheaper, and diagnosis of it is probably a lot easier as well. But probably the places where I can think about where the cons or the limitations probably come up is now you have a lot more wires that are running into the car because each of these units has to send its own signal back to, you know, maybe a central ECU. And that's why you see these really long cables running from one end to the other. And it was very surprising for me to find out that, like, in manufacturing of a car, it actually does add a lot to the BOM cost of the car, the bill of materials of the car, because you have all these multiple lengths of cables running in different directions, front, back, left, right, all of that. Versus, you know, if you switch gears to central architecture, central compute architecture, I think this is going to probably happen over time, but not there yet, because the idea of this is you have your central computing unit, maybe your SoC or central ECU over there, which is going to be very computationally heavy because it's getting in a lot of data. And you primarily have a couple of zones around the vehicle. And so the zones pretty much could be, in some cases I've seen cars have like a front zone and a back zone, or they have four zones, like, you know, two zones left, right in the front, two zones left, right in the back. And this forms, like, you know, you must have heard this term, zonal architecture. That's what this essentially implies, that you've got these zones around the car. And the point is that you have some type of maybe a sensor hub or connectivity hub that connects into this zone over here. And then you have high-speed data paths that are coming from the zone to the central compute. So essentially, your engine control data, your engine controllers, headlight controllers, maybe ABS controllers, they all get mapped into these zones, into these particular zones of the car. They'll definitely have their own tags and their own IDs, so you can know which sensor has signaled a different thing. But the idea over here is that you have high-speed data links that are coming from these zones over here to the central compute. It's probably going to be some variant of automotive Ethernet, probably several gigs or maybe tens or hundreds of gigs, just because of the data throughput that you require. Architecture-wise, this probably will become simpler because now you have all your, you know, connectivity probably consolidated in your zones, and then you, you know, in a very loose sense, you have a Ethernet wire which is going from your zone to your central compute. So while it could reduce the amount of wiring and simplify the wiring from the zone to the central compute, the disadvantage, which I think right now and over time it could get addressed, is one, you know, the overall market adoption, because it's a big change to the traditional architecture that we're doing. Second, it puts a lot of emphasis also on the central compute, because typically what you would have is maybe you might have some amount of processing that is happening on this zone, and then majority of the data is being sent back to the central compute. If it's raw data, then you can think about that this zone is primarily a big SerDes block that is just taking in data, serializing it, sending it over a high-speed bus over there to the central compute. If all this data is coming into the central compute from maybe four or five different zones, you can assume that central compute is going to be doing a lot of computation over there. That's going to add to power. It's probably going to add to heat, and it's going to add to cost also, because if there is a problem that has happened on the central compute unit, then you have to assume that the car probably has to be taken into the shop. That whole console has to be changed out, because it's probably easier to swap it that way rather than just desoldering a circuit board, or, you know, but that's probably going to add to the overall cost, because now that piece of silicon is going to be very expensive that is over there. And if it does get buggy, it can have some critical issues, because if you malfunction your car is driving, you can have a problem. Plus also the data path going from the zone to your central compute will have to be very, very high speed. So there's going to be some automotive grade wiring which will need to provide that level of throughput that will go from one end to the other and back. So pros and cons on both sides. But the good thing is, you know, as a IP provider, within Tensilica, we have IPs to support this for the compute point of view, and then our sister groups within the SSG, the Silicon Solutions Group, has other IPs to support many of these protocols as well.
Great. A final question. When do you see this taking off?
So that's a great question, Daniel. I think it's definitely going to be a little bit of time, because this is right now mostly on paper, and there might be some early adopters who are starting to go down this path. I think you can probably guess, you know, one of the EV manufacturers in the US that more or less adopts this path, where everything is drive by wire and controlled from a central processing unit and a central console. But I think for mass adoption, it is definitely going to take some time. But what we can definitely say adjacent to that is, you can see that over the years, the amount of silicon going into the car and semiconductors going into the car is drastically increasing. You're starting to see a lot of smart computes coming into the car. Whether it is, you know, high performance, high efficiency electronics coming in the car as separate SoCs, or you're starting to see multiple SoCs coming into the car, that's the direction the things are moving. Because there's two things to remember. We've been focused primarily on, you know, you've got radars and you've got cameras and all this compute happening together. But there's another big factor also over there is, you know, what about V2X? V2X being standing for vehicle to everything, right? Or vehicle to anything. This is where you have the vehicles talking to the infrastructure, you're talking to the neighboring cars, you're talking to the roads, you're talking to the phones, and all of that. So as this starts picking up, as well as you have, you know, smart intersections, where right now when you go into a traffic light, the light changes color, and then the driver, you know, steers or goes straight depending on whatever he or she wants to do. Over time, you can assume that this is going to be something that the vehicle is going to negotiate with the infrastructure, and there's going to be a lot of data throughput that is going to be required to process, because the car is going to be talking to the infrastructure, the intersection is going to be talking to the cars around it, and then figuring out how to drive. So a simple analogy of this is, you have a big router at home, or maybe in a data center. There's a lot of data orchestration that is happening to make sure that when you ask for a YouTube video, which may be hosted in India or on the other side of the world, there's a lot of bits of data that go through all these different networks, and finally it comes to your place. So same principle applies over here to the car as well, because now you have one car over here, you have several cars around you at the intersection, and cars which are probably not in your line of sight that are all being traffic managed and communicated, so that the traffic is constantly flowing, and there's no blockage or traffic jams or roadblocks. So as this other vector also comes into picture, you can see that there will be a lot more semiconductor and electronics also coming into the cars as well.
Right. Hey, great conversation. Thank you very much, and hope to get an update maybe early next year.
Yes, Daniel, absolutely. This was a great conversation with you. I hope I was able to give you some good insights on some of the things we are seeing in the future of semiconductor, both from IP and automotive, and how we see this, you know, how our world evolving and getting more AI and more semiconductor in the cars.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.